John chapter 1 this morning. We are going to be spending time between now and the end of the year in John's Gospel. And this is not going to be an exhaustive expository series through John. It's really going to be more of a brief excursus in the book of John. Or as they say in Uganda, so I taught in Uganda, and they don't say a soft O, they don't say ah. And so they would correct me and say, we're not studying the Gospel of John, we're studying the Gospel of John. And so however you want to understand it, I still have a fond heart to hearing them speak of this Gospel that way and their eagerness to enjoy God from it. We're going to be spending some time between now and the end of the year, roughly about seven or so Sundays, not including Advent in there, to kind of survey and peruse through some of this Gospel. Again, I've said it's not going to be an exhaustive exposition of this Gospel. Really, my aim is to highlight some big ideas, some what I believe are some life-giving themes for our faith from John's Gospel. So even this morning, I just want to level set expectations. There's rich. We could have a whole series, a sermon series, just from John chapter 1 because of how big these ideas are and how deep the theology of even just chapter 1 is. But we're not going to do that. Really, what I want to do as we spend time in this Gospel is to highlight and emphasize the idea or the reality of relationship with God. And not do it in like a systematic theology way, but in a way that's practical and hopefully will be encouraging you to lean into and explore the riches that God has offered you of relationship with Him through Christ. That is what I hope for us to have, all of us, and together as a church family, to have a richer and greater and more meaningful experience of relationship with God through Christ. I wonder if over time Christianity can start to become more of a form of religion to us, kind of a code of life, a way that we conduct ourselves, a way of making decisions. And certainly it includes that, but that isn't sufficient to describe how the Scriptures talk about Christianity. There's a vitality to the language found in the Scriptures about how you relate, how a person would have a relationship with God, and what that would be like. And so wherever you are at on the spectrum of how you would maybe rate your relationship with God, perhaps you feel like you are riding the wave, right? And you're experiencing richness and depth and excitement. Praise God for that. I want to encourage you to keep riding that wave. Or maybe you feel like the wave has crashed on top of you and you're tumbling in the surf trying to find air. Well, I hope that the Gospel of John will encourage you to keep swimming, because there's glory waiting for you. There's a richness that maybe you might not even dare imagine, but God has. So as we begin in looking in John 1, I want us to look at, we need to understand, to frame this up, how we approach this chapter, we need to frame it up by understanding why did the Apostle John write this Gospel. And the good news is we don't have to make that up. We don't have to just kind of obliquely surmise and try to, you know, look between the lines. He tells us exactly why he wrote it. So if you look back in John 20, and I'll have it here on screen for you, but in John 20, he says that Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples which are not written in this book. So that's just a good reminder that this Gospel is not an exhaustive record of everything Jesus did or said. But these are written. Here's why John did write these things. Of all of the many things that could have been included, all the things that were not included, John shows these things for this reason. These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. But that's not enough. John wants that belief to have an effect, to bring about a particular result. Here's the purpose. And that by believing, you may have life in His name. Life in His name. So John gives us this purpose statement, why he writes, that we might have life in his name through believing who Jesus is, to have a truthful understanding, a belief about who Jesus really is. We might have life in his name. Question for you. Imagine a 10-year-old walks up to you and says, this would be quite a 10-year-old, right? That says this, what is life? Imagine that, right? We're looking for children's workers, people that are willing to answer 10-year-olds asking questions like that. Who's in? Okay? All right, that would be profound. That's a profound question, but just let's try it out, okay? Usually, just want you to think, what is life? How would you answer that 10-year-old? What would you say? Well, here's another exciting thing about this gospel. We don't have to wonder what that is. John chapter 17, John records Jesus answering that question. What is life? Here's what Jesus says. This is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. So according to John 17, according to Jesus' words that John's recorded here in John 17, this is life. And the term there, knowing, in John 17:3, is not a term to describe factual understanding, as if you're going to pull off the shelf the encyclopedia. I know kids, you or younger people, they actually had encyclopedias that were printed and bound and put on shelves once upon a time. But it's not just the Wikipedia knowledge of God. That's not it. This word knowing is a particular word that describes experience. This idea of this rich relational experience of knowledge. So it's not reading about how honey is sweet, if I can use this analogy. It's not just reading in a book about how honey is sweet. The knowing here is tasting it for yourself. That kind of experience. So the definition of life then is to relate with and to experience and to associate in a personal relationship with God. That's life. I wonder, how would you define life? What makes life worth living for you? What is it that if you didn't have, you would start to lose your desire to exist? What is life to you? John the Apostle records what Jesus teaches about life, and life is all about relating with and personally experiencing and knowing God personally, as a person. And you say, well, how does that have anything to do with John 1? Well, a lot, actually. And this is going to be a philosophical, we're going to be swimming through philosophical waters this morning, okay? So buckle up, all right? But the language John uses here in these opening lines sounds very familiar to the creation account. You see that in the beginning, those first few words? It sounds very familiar to Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God. Here we have, in the beginning was the Word. And so this idea of the Word here in John 1 is a particularly profound, deep idea. This word that John uses, of course, he's writing in the Greek, and that Greek term that he uses here is the word logos. So it reads literally, then, in the beginning was the logos. Now, John deliberately used a word here that had enormous, enormous philosophical significance for his Greco-Roman reader of that day. Greek philosophers of the day had been debating, had been coming up with this idea of a logos. They're trying to make sense of the world, of the word, of the world. Sorry. They're trying to make sense of the world. And so they're debating. And they theorize that there has to be some sort of transcendent principle at work in the world that provides order and harmony and meaning for life. There was some sort of cosmic principle behind it all, and these Greek philosophers called it the Logos. This Logos is this term that the Greek philosophers used to say this is the meaning and purpose of life is derived from understanding the logos that stands behind life. So maybe that sounds a bit odd, but if you think of it this way, that we do this all the time. You are going to try to understand how to use something, how it should be used, okay? Let's say you get, you name it, all right? A new coffee maker or whatever else it might be, and you're going to open up, okay, some of you won't, but others of us will open up an instruction manual, and you'll start reading through and start to learn, how am I supposed to use this item? How should this thing be experienced? And it'll tell you, don't do things like this. Don't use the toaster oven near the tub. It'll tell you that. It gives you understanding, and it helps you realize the purpose of it, how it should be used so that it can fulfill its design. That is the logos, the word. Now, that has a profound influence on your quality of life, because if you start going through life, and our modern day idea would be freedom, you're free to choose meaning for yourself. However you'd like. That is the fullness of how life should be. You choose what meaning is for you. But that's not satisfying. And nor is it really freedom either. Because it's not freedom to use, think of the absurd illustration that I heard. It's not freedom to use a piano to cut your grass. If you were trying to do that with a piano, you would say, this thing is worthless. This is ridiculous. It's a piece of garbage, this piano. Doesn't cut grass at all. It's horrible at it. Well, you would say, that's because you don't understand the meaning or the purpose of it. But when you understand that a piano is meant to create music, to produce music, now you can use it and you're in alignment with why it was made. You're in alignment with the logos. That's the idea that John starts this gospel with. And he wants you to know how to have life, how to experience life. What is a meaningful, purposeful, enriched life? And he wants you to have life in Christ, in his name, to know who Jesus is, so that you can know and relate with God, because God is the Logos. That's where he's going. So if life does have this Logos, if there is this divine purpose and meaning behind everything, then you would want to live in alignment with that, the Greek philosophers would say. So, if you did live in alignment with it, they theorize that life would ordinarily go better for you, or at least you could have more things to be, it wouldn't be as chaotic or random for you. And if you didn't live in alignment with the logos that stood behind life, then you could at least experience frustration or, at worst, destruction. But here's the problem. The Greek philosophers couldn't agree on what was the logos. They couldn't agree. There were different schools of thought. You have the Greek Stoics, okay? And they believe that there's everything in life, you just need to accept it. You need to have a stiff upper lip, you need to accept suffering, accept death, don't let it get to you, detach from all of that. That's one way to have a happy life. Just live in alignment with all of these things that are coming at you stoically. Well, there were others that said that's not right, and they said you need to do good things, good deeds, give yourself to noble purposes, noble causes. Altruism, that is the meaning of life. There were others that disagreed with that and said that's ridiculous because we're just going to die and rot into the ground, and so eat, live, and be merry, the Epicureans would say. They said the meaning of life is to find happiness and pleasure, hedonism. That's where you find meaning in life. That's the logos. Who's right? What is life? John writes the gospel to introduce us to life itself. And he writes the gospel and he says that there is a logos. You see in the beginning of John 1, in the beginning was the logos. There is something standing behind all of life. There is. But the Greek philosophers were looking for principles or laws or rules for right living to align themselves with. And John says, no. There is a logos, but it's not a principle. The Logos is a person. A person. And that changes everything. Because if the heart of the universe is not impersonal, as the Greeks thought, but if it's a person, then that would mean that there's an enormous emphasis for life on relationship. More particularly, more specifically, on love. John says the secret, the structure, the meaning of everything that stands behind life has come into this world as flesh and blood, not as a principle. The ultimate reality of the universe is not an abstract force, it's not a power, it's not just randomness, it is God, and He is love. So at the center of the universe is a personal God who, because of love, has come into this world to save us and to make it possible for us to know Him and relate with Him. And when that happens, you experience life. That changes everything. Because if you do not have a relationship with the Logos, with God Himself standing behind what makes life meaningful and purposeful for you, then you have to replace it with something else, either an object or an idea. So maybe you're going to say, well, the principle of life is wisdom. That sounds noble. Well, what happens when you're not wise? Your Logos just crushed you and destroys you. Or you say, well, it's to be strong and successful. That is the meaning of life. That's the Logos. Well, what happens when you fail? It crushes you. Or you say, no, it's to live a moral life. And a lot of religion, that's what it is, right? People go through life feeling like they are compensating for the chaos in their own life and in the world around them by living a morally ordered life. But what happens when you are not moral? What happens when you fall short of the moral requirements you know in your own conscience? You see, Christianity is not just another version of religion. Christianity is entirely different. Christianity, according to John in this gospel, according to the Bible, says there is transcendent meaning to life, and the meaning of life, or life itself, is a person who invites you into a relationship of love. That's Christianity. And that's what he's talking about here in those first five verses when he talks about this eternal word. He's introducing us to Christ, not in a manger. It's different from all the other gospels. He's introducing us to Christ, not in a manger in Bethlehem, but he takes us into the realm of eternity. It's like walking into I can't remember the name of the word right now, it just escapes me, where you go and you see pictures of stars, you lay on your back and you try not to fall asleep while they show you the show. What is that called? Planetarium. Yeah, he takes you into this planetarium of eternity. That's where he takes you, to introduce you to life. This word is a person, not a principle. And he talks about him personally. You see in verse 2, he says, He was with God in the beginning. It's not just it. He, this is personal. There's a relationship there. He is with God, but yet He is God, right? And so John, right on the opening gates here in his gospel, introduces us to Trinitarian theology. And the meaning of life at the center of all of it is a God who Himself has always been in a community of relationship, Father, Son, and Spirit. And they've been pouring glory and joy and delight and love into one another for all eternity. This is who John introduces us to, so that we might have life. And so the Christian Logos means the universe wasn't born out of loneliness or need, but out of an overflow of love. So, then we understand, according to John 1, that we were made by love and we were made for love. But here's the problem. Most of the loves of our life always disappoint us or hurt us or damage us or disappoint us or frustrate us or die on us. And John is going to introduce you to something that will never happen to that. It won't. You see in verse 3, through Him all things were made. The Word is not part of creation. This Logos is the Creator. He is the source of life, the giver of light, everything that exists. Every person, every star, every planet, every galaxy has meaning only in relationship to Him. You see verse 4 and 5, in Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. This idea of light, these big contrasts that John is going to use all throughout his gospel, but these stark contrasts between light and darkness, life and death. You see, often we think of light in a very kind of Western idea of trying to have our path illuminated so we can make decisions about where we should walk in life and the path we should take. We often turn it into kind of like a guidebook. Like God is a guidebook for us. And we need this. We need to know what stone to step on next to get across the river of life, so to speak. And while sure, the Bible does include a guidance for life, but it is so much more than that. That's not sufficient. Jesus isn't a guidebook. He is life itself. That's what John is introducing us to. So think about it. What elements are necessary for life? Right? All of you are like, well, you're not a biologist. Just think of it, right? I mean, we're looking for, when I say we, the human race, we've been looking for life out there, right? And we're looking for certain elements. Water's a big one, right? We're looking for water. What else are we looking for? Looking for some sort of nutrient, some sort of way for life to exist, something to allow life to exist, nutrients, right? Whether that's some sort of in soil kind of an idea, or in air, or there's going to be some of those elements that bring life. And then you also have to have light. Like imagine if you tried to plant a garden in utter darkness and never expose it to light, nothing would grow, would it? Do you realize that through the Gospel of John, John is going to show us and introduce us to Jesus, and Jesus uses words like this to describe himself. He is the light of the world. And Jesus is going to identify and proclaim himself, and John's going to show it to us. Jesus says, I am the water of life. And Jesus is also going to say, I am the bread of life. You see all that put together, John is presenting to us that Jesus is not just a way of life. He is life. Because he brings you into relationship with God, because he is God with us. But in verses 10 through 13, what's we're shown here is that it's kind of this whole big story of the Bible, that things went wrong, that the light of the world is rejected. This true light comes into the world, yet the world does not recognize him. They do not receive him. And this is one of the great ironies of the story of the world, that the Creator walks into his own creation and creation doesn't know him and they reject him. And that's our fallen, sinful condition as humans. We long for truth and beauty, and yet we resist the one who is truth and beauty in flesh. And so you think, well, it's all lost? We're doomed? No. It's not, because you see verse 12? Grace breaks through. This is the good news of Christianity. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And this teaches us something important about what it means to become a Christian, what it means to know God, to have life. Becoming a Christian is not like joining a club. It's not like getting a library card or a Sam's card. No, it's like being born all over again. It's like being a child. You see the language there in verse 12, not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And by the way, John is going to unpack that more in chapter 3. That whole idea about you've got to be born again, you've got to be a child of God, there's going to be a dialogue about that, that John is going to slow down and give us a story where Jesus explains that. So new life is not achieved, we learn here. It is received. Life is received. Boy, that's good news. How do you receive this life? Well, that's verse 14. There is so much depth here. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. John's phrasing there literally is he pitched his tent among us. He tabernacled among us is the terms that are used there. It echoes this Old Testament idea of the tabernacle where God's glory resided behind a veil. And what is a tabernacle or what is a temple? All around the world, religions have temples, right? There's this instinctive awareness in us as a human race as we seek for the divine that there is some sort of gap between us and the divine. God is great, we are not. God is perfect, we are not. So temples, right, all around the world are these places that are meant to, like, bridge this gap between us and the divine. And so we bring offerings and there's sacrifices and there's atonement. Something has to be done to bridge that gap. Priests are there to kind of do this full time. But now we're told that Jesus is the tabernacle. We're told that he becomes the temple. And we begin to understand that the Christian gospel tells us that he is the ultimate priest. He makes the ultimate sacrifice. He bridges that gap and he removes the need for temples so that we can become children of God. That's life. That's not religion. That's life. And so the Christian religion, if I can say it that way, is the end of religion as the world has known it. No more temples, no more priests or sacrifices. Jesus is all three. Every other religion in the world says, do these things and you'll be accepted. Do this and live. And Christianity says, no, no, look and live. And that's profound. God does not make us into his employees. He doesn't just make us into his servants. He calls us friends and he makes us his children. And that changes the whole way then that you would orient yourself in toward life. I mean, it changes everything. That emphasis on relationship that is right here in the beginning and that goes all through the gospel is knowing and enjoying God because he knows he will know and enjoy you through the forgiveness that he offers through life. Think of it. How do you relate to your employee, your employer? I know there's all sorts of like language that talks about, you know, that businesses use. We're family here, right? And they try to use that terminology. Why are they trying so hard to use that terminology in the marketplace like that? Well, because you're understanding that there's a certain quality of relationship that should be experienced in family that is covenant-based. It is not consumer-based. But at the end of the day, I mean, an employer and employee relationship is often considered more consumeristic. You're hired, you're doing something, you're paid a wage to do that product, do that thing. If you stop doing that thing, well, then you don't have a reason. That's not the way God relates to us. God relates to us not out of consumer base, but he relates to us through a covenant. We are his children. And all of this idea of relationship with God here in John chapter 1, when you get into verses 14 through 18, the language that starts to be used here is all about this idea of glory. Look at verse 14. We've seen his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And this flows right out of this idea of Jesus tabernacling with us. Why did you go to the tabernacle? It was to experience God, to experience his glory, because that's where it resided. Now we understand that Jesus is that tabernacle. And so if you think back to Exodus 33 and 34, you can read it later, but it's this amazing encounter between a human and God, between Moses and God. And there's this conversation that takes place where Moses wants to see God. But no one can see God, right? You see verse 18 of John 1? No one has ever seen God. Does that bother you? Worship. Order your life. But you can't ever see him. Well, Moses wanted to see God. And God basically tells Moses, you can't handle me. You can't see me and exist. Like if you see, he basically tells Moses, it's impossible. You will disintegrate to be that close and to experience glory like that. And so God says, I'm going to put you in a crevasse. And I'm going to have rock shelter you from the solar flare, so to speak, of God's glory. And God passes by. And you know what the glory of God is described as in Exodus 33 and 34? You know what starts to happen? Moses doesn't really see the glory of God. What does Moses experience? What sense? Do you remember this? Sorry, you didn't know this was going to be like a Bible quiz, did you? What did he see? Some of you know this. What does he experience? What sense is it? He hears the Logos of God. The Lord, gracious and merciful, abounding in steadfast love. I mean, that's what he experiences. And so what we have here is John the Apostle is saying, listen, we've seen the glory of God. We've experienced something Moses could only wish for, that he longed for. We've experienced it. We have experienced the glory of God. No one has ever seen God, verse 18, right? Well, wait, how? But we have in Jesus. We've experienced life. So the unscalable majesty of God, the transcendent holiness of God becomes a person in Jesus. So let's circle back to where John began here as we conclude. Why does John call Jesus the Word, the Logos? Because John, right out of the gates here, wants to confront his reader with the questions that have been churning around in the culture of that day, around the meaning and purpose of life, how to order a life, how to know a life well lived. And John is taking that conversation and he's saying, listen, Christianity, this good news, this way, has the answers. And it's not a principle, it's a person. All of us are going to live for some center. We're all going to live for some reason. Everyone has a logos. What's yours? And maybe it's something like a relationship, right? Maybe you're like, oh, see, there's a relationship there, but here's the problem. Is that relationship that is ultimate? Is it God? Is it knowing and relating to Him? Or is it some other relationship? Is it a spouse? Is it an imaginary person that you think could bring you that fulfillment? Is it a child? Maybe it's success or beauty or approval or family or security or freedom or comfort. And by the way, none of those things are evil or bad in and of themselves. But what happens is when we start to live a life with that as our logos, we will lose our life. Because Jesus says, what does it profit if you gain the whole what? World, but lose your life. What is your logos? The Gospel of John is a warning and an invitation. It's a warning, don't choose wrongly. Because if you choose a logos for your life that is not God, if you choose to build your life on something that is not God, it will eventually fail you and it will crush you. You will spend your life chasing these lesser logoses, and one day you'll either be staring at either your own mortality or you'll be staring into the grave of that thing or that person's mortality, and you will be wondering what it was all for. But if Jesus is your logos, if He is the reason you get up in the morning, if He is the center around which your life turns, then everything changes. And here's the frustration that we can feel, because what I just said seems too good to be true. It almost seems like that's impossible. But it's not. It is true. And the Gospel of John is going to show that. Jesus is the life. He is the light. He is the bread. He is the water. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the shepherd. He is the gate. John just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing the reality of Jesus as life in front of his readers to get it through to us. Jesus is not only the reason for life. He is the power of life. He is life itself. So John's Gospel shows us that we can know and experience the deepest meaning and purpose in life by knowing and relating and experiencing God. And there's all sorts of implications that flow out of that. One danger that we have in our American context is we start to drill down and double down on that personally, privately, individually. And there's a place for that. But the Gospel of John, Jesus' own words, are going to show a different kind of experience of relationship with God that is not particularly only personal, private, individual. It is not. It is exasperatingly communal. I mean, think of it this way. Peter's worst moment in life, I know we're just We're jumping ahead around because this is kind of orienting us to the book of John. I want us to get the idea of relationship. If you go out with one idea here, I want you to understand this. There is so much more for you to understand and experience in relationship with God than you dare imagine. And John wants to be like appetizers. He wants to tease us and get us thirsty and hungry for God. Okay, but think of Peter, right? What was his worst moment in life? If you've been Christian for a while, you know it, right? It's when he denied Jesus. Do you know when did Jesus talk to Peter about that? They're on the beach. Was it this uniquely private, personal moment? It doesn't seem to be. Jesus had just made them breakfast. They just had this big haul of fish. It feels this. It's like a really awkward. When you think about it from a modern case, you're kind of like, couldn't you guys just kind of walk over there and chat for a little while? This is awkward. And then they're talking, and then immediately in their whole conversation, Peter's like, well, what about that guy? What about John? And he starts comparing. And it's this. I'm just saying. The whole experience of God is very communal. It's community. But there's a richness in that too. Knowing God is to know love and to experience a relationship that cannot be lost. That is what John is going to show us in Christ. John's gospel shows us that we can know and experience the deepest meaning and purpose in life by knowing and relating and experiencing God. So, what do we do with this? Well, I'll have our music team come and get prepared to lead us in our final song. Friends, I just want us to kind of reset our perspective toward relating with God. Come at it with a fresh perspective. Not from the routine, but this idea that God will surprise you, surprise us, with a relationship that has nuance and depth and texture and richness that we might have yet not discovered.